Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is science journalist and editor Keith Cooper, and we're talking about his new book, Amazing Worlds, of Science Fiction and Science Fact. Keith, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be on.
I have to say, this has got to be one of the most entertaining books on cosmology and astrophysics. Any book that starts the first sentence with the name James Tiberius Kirk is going to be a whale of a ride, and this was. How did you decide to work on this book? What prompted you?
Oh, it was a convergence of my two passions, science fiction and astronomy and space exploration. And any opportunity I get to combine the two, I take. My background is a science journalist. I studied astrophysics at university and have worked as a science journalist for the past 20 years. So writing about the universe and space exploration. But I've been a science fiction fan going back to very early childhood. One of the growing areas of space exploration and astronomy at the moment is searching for exoplanets, planets around other stars. And of course, in science fiction, a lot of science fiction is about going to planets around other stars. So it just seemed to me a really good way of presenting the science through science fiction that readers may be familiar with and be able to relate to.
That relationship between the hard science of searching for exoplanets and science fiction is real. I really learned a lot from your book. It was fascinating to learn how many scientists were inspired to get into the field that they did because of science fiction.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by how many scientists that I spoke to responded to that as well. There was a survey over here in the UK last year, I think it was, of scientists at one of the national astronomy meetings about whether they were interested in science fiction. And I can't remember the exact proportions, but most were. And those that weren't for the sole reason that it reminded them too much of work, which I can understand, I suppose. I think so many of us are inspired by science fiction who then take up science as a career, because I guess that's our first exposure to science as a youngster, through science fiction.
Now, getting back to the discovery of exoplanets, first of all, as you write in your book, no other planet has been discovered so far that's like Earth is known, but the number of exoplanets that has been discovered is huge.
It is. We just recently crossed the 6,000 mark. So there's 6,000 planets known out in the cosmos orbiting other stars. There's thousands more unconfirmed candidates. We only discovered the first ones. The 30th anniversary is coming up next month in October 2025. The first planet around a sun-like star was found back in 1995. So it's only taken us 30 years to get up to 6,000 exoplanets. But you're quite right. Even though we've found big gas giants and we've found planets that are rocky, we've found planets that are very hot, we've found planets that are very cold, we haven't found any. Or at least we haven't identified any yet that are like Earth. And when I say like Earth, I mean, a nice cozy temperature, oceans of liquid water, continents, vegetation, and a breathable atmosphere, and of course, life.
Now we need to spend a few minutes talking for the benefit of the audience about how these exoplanets are discovered. They're not being directly visually seen in the way that we can look at Mars. Because of the distances involved, scientists are using all sorts of ways to determine, first of all, that it's a planet, and then maybe a few things about what it's composed of, what its atmosphere is like. Can you address that?
Yeah, sure. We can directly image a few. These tend to be very big, very hot, As in, they've just formed still, so they're emitting a lot of thermal infrared radiation. And they tend to be quite far from their star, so they're out of the star's glare. So we have directly imaged a few, and there's this fantastic movie made up of images taken over several years that shows several planets moving around part of their orbit around their star. And it's just this wonderful demonstration of Kepler's laws of orbital motion. But we've only imaged about 100 and, out of 6,000. You're right that the way that we discover exoplanets is mostly indirect ways. We're looking for their gravitational effect on their star that causes their star to wobble slightly on its rotational axis. And we can measure that wobble just a few meters per second, but we can measure it in the Doppler shift of their light. And the Doppler shift is the stretching and compressing of in this case, light waves. But people will be more familiar with the Doppler shift through when an emergency vehicle goes past with its siren blaring and the pitch of the siren changes right. as it goes past. And that's just because the sound waves are being compressed and then stretched out as the emergency vehicle, ambulance, police car, whatever, drives past. The other way is to watch for when a planet actually passes in front of its star from our point of view, and that blocks a small fraction of the star's light. So the biggest planet in our solar system is Jupiter, and that would block about 1% of a star's light if a planet of a similar size we saw transiting, they call it transiting, passing in front of the star. An Earth-sized planet would block 0.01%, but our instruments are so sensitive that it can actually detect these slight dips in light as the planet moves in front. And based on the size of the dip, we can work out how big the planet is. Based on the size of the wobble of the Doppler shift, of the, the planet's gravity pulling on its star, we can work out how massive it must be. Combine those two, and we can calculate its density and determine whether it's rocky or gaseous or water or a combination of those. So yeah, it's all indirect. We haven't got nice pictures of, as you say, our telescopes can take pictures of Mars and Jupiter. The images that we do have, they're just very little points of light. But the aim, one day, would be to be able to take a picture of one of these planets. But we need much bigger telescopes.
What's the closest exoplanet? And when we're saying exoplanet, we're talking about planets outside of our solar system. So what's the closest really definite exoplanet?
Yeah, the closest is actually around the closest star to our sun, which is Proxima Centauri. It's a red dwarf star, 4.2 light years away. So when we look at the star, we're actually seeing as it was 4.2 years ago. That's how long it has taken the light to get to us. But that's the closest star to us. That shows just how big space is. And that star has three planets, and one of them, excitingly, is they're all rocky, but one of them is in what we call the habitable zone. This is the region around the star at the right distance where, if a planet has an atmosphere similar to Earth, then it would be able to support liquid water on its surface. And as far as we know, all life requires liquid water, so astronomers describe this as the habitable zone. It doesn't mean that the planet is inhabited. It just means that there's the potential for conditions to be right for it to be inhabited. We don't actually know if it has liquid water at this stage. But yeah, that's the closest one, and there's still so little we know about it because it's really difficult to make these observations. If we ever do able to send an interstellar probe into space beyond the solar system, that would be one of our first targets.
Now, I want to get back into science fiction for a second. There's been changes in the way science fiction authors have portrayed exoplanets after about the 1990s. Why is that? Now, I grew up in the 50s. So I grew up with authors like Robert J. Heinlein. I grew up with stories like Martian Odyssey. Classic, they explore another planet that may have life on it, may have civilizations. It was like the old classic science fiction stories of the ones that I grew up with. But contemporary science fiction is taking a different attitude towards planets outside of the solar system.
Yeah, there's a multifaceted answer to that. So as I mentioned, our first exoplanets that we discovered, we didn't find them until the mid-1990s. So science fiction written before then, before we knew these planets existed, we assumed they did, but we didn't know for sure. So science fiction was going out on a limb a little bit. You know, when Star Trek voyaged to strange new worlds, nobody knew if these strange new worlds even existed. So it was a little bit of a leap of faith. And so, you know, there were no astronomers to tell the science fiction writers, oh, a planet can't be like that, a planet can't be like this, because we didn't know of any planets. So science fiction writers had free rein to depict their planets as they wanted. They weren't constrained by real-life discoveries. Whereas I think now science fiction writers, you know, because science fiction writers, you know, they love science as well, and they keep on top of the scientific discoveries. So it's natural that science fiction writers are going to want, you know, their fictional planet to be as realistic as possible. So they look to what we have discovered and maybe base their planets on that. The other thing as well is there was a study by a researcher at the University of St. Andrews, and she was looking at how, you know, what we've been talking about, the different types of planet in science fiction and how that has changed over the years in response to exoplanet discoveries. And one of the trends she noticed was that more modern science fiction tended to have fewer planets where, you know, we had colonized it, you know, and she thought maybe that was to do with a growing awareness of the damage that colonialism did. In history. But also, you know, as I said, we haven't found another planet like Earth. You know, back in when they were filming Star Trek in the 60s, every planet they went to was like Earth, in, you know, in the sense that people could survive on the surface. And it's, you know, we haven't found any like that. And I think science fiction writers are just adjusting how Earth-like they make their fictional planets. And one of the things they often do now is the whole planet won't be habitable like the Earth is, but maybe there'll be a niche.
Right.
Just part of the planet that might be habitable.
And there are science fiction stories that are definitely about these niche areas, like it'll be a deep canyon, and only down in the bottom of the canyon will people be able to survive.
Absolutely. Larry Niven, you know, wrote many stories like that. And that, you know, that continues to this day. People like Alistair Reynolds has written. Even Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune. If you think about Arrakis, a desert planet.
Well, you have a whole chapter on desert planets. And what I love is that scientists will also apply themselves to trying to figure out what would, if there really was an Arrakis planet, how would people survive? And there are several other examples of desert planets. Tatooine in Star Wars. Mm. Like, what would life be like on these desert planets? It sounds like it would be a lot more difficult than they're portrayed in the movies and the books.
Yeah, I think for human life, certainly, wouldn't be what we're used to. Imagine having to live in the Sahara all the time. You know, there are people who do that, but to those of us in the West, used to living in our cities, with a, you know, it would be quite difficult. I think, you know, as you say, scientists actually doing studies about fictional planets, that speaks to the strength of the science fiction, I think,
right.
The respect that scientists hold it in. Frank Herbert, when he wrote Dune, he'd been a journalist before a novelist. He'd written a lot about dune fields in California and, you know, how they were being preserved. So he learned a lot about that kind of environment, and he was able then to apply that to the novel. And, you know, in his novel, you know, it's the polar regions of the planet that are habitable.
Right.
The equatorial region is not really very habitable, although I think the Fremen, the native people on the planet, are able to live there, but with some difficulty. And even in the recent film, they journey south and they have to go through that equatorial band, and it's a really dangerous journey. That's a niche habitat there as well, where they only can live at the poles. But yeah, the scientific study so far, scientists they as you say, they wrote this scientific paper about, whether planets like Dune could exist and whether they could be habitable. Because you think a desert world, not much water, would be really difficult to live on. It turns out that habitable desert worlds might be more common in the universe than Earth-like worlds that are all lush with lots of water and vegetation. Partly because Earth itself is a niche. People may have heard of the habitable zone also being called the Goldilocks zone.
Right.
As in Goldilocks and the Three Bears, because everything has to be just right. It has to be just perfect for life to be there. So Earth is very much a niche world. Change, just adjust the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere a little bit, or take away the plate tectonics that helps to recycle carbon, or remove the moon, and then the Earth's tilt might start to wobble, which would affect the climate over long-time periods. Our habitat is really finely balanced. It's one of these reasons why we're so concerned about, human-induced climate change, because it's disrupting that. Desert worlds, as long as they have a little bit of water, they could potentially be habitable for longer, because they don't have enough water. Water is a greenhouse gas.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a lot of steam in the atmosphere, it absorbs more heat from the sun, warms the planet. Well, you don't have much water in the first place. You're not going to get too much greenhouse heating. Similarly, if it's too far from the sun, if you don't have too much water, then the whole planet isn't going to freeze over. Of course, it might be too cold if it's too far, but it just widens the habitable zone. And I think when we're talking about looking for planets like Earth, we need to broaden our horizons a little bit and look for just planets that could be habitable in any kind of way. Rather than just looking for a mirror image of our planet. We found quite a lot of planets in the habitable zone of stars, but we just don't know enough about them to say what they're like at all, which is a little bit frustrating, but we just have to wait for our technology, our instruments, to be able to catch up, to be able to show us.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is science journalist and editor Keith Cooper, and we're talking about his new book. It is really enjoyable. Amazing Worlds of Science Fiction and Science Fact. Just the title of your book reminds me of like one of those science fiction magazines from like the 50s and then the early 60s. And I think the Science Fiction, Science Fact, that was the subtitle for Analog originally.
It was.
Yeah. Now, there's so many. Go ahead.
I was going to say that was a deliberate riff on. There was Amazing Stories, I think.
That's right. That's right.
20s. And then you say Science Fiction and Science Fact was the tagline for Analog. So yeah, that was a nod towards those. Yeah.
There are some parts of this book that just made me laugh. You were talking about how science fiction, were writing about how science fiction has inspired many astronomers. And there's one from Caltech, Jesse Christensen, who's described her role as being like Slatty Bartfar from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide. I can't believe she said that.
I had a feeling she was a fan of Douglas Adams when I was speaking to her. Her job is to simulate planets in computer simulations. And the reason that scientists do that is because, I talked about how we discover these planets indirectly. Like a blip on a graph, basically. So we try to translate that blip, that signal, into what it must be like. So by running the models, we can apply the data to the models and see which models best fit the data.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what she does, and she'll just simulate lots of different planetary systems so that when we detect planets and we get the signal back and we're scratching our heads trying to figure out what it means, we can just look towards the models and say which best fits this data.
Huh.
So that's what she does, but
I think that's a great description. Now, there's so many weird details in your book. For instance, you're talking about the classic science fiction writer E.E. Doc Smith. Besides being a very famous classic science fiction writer, he figured out how to get powdered sugar to stick to donuts.
Yes. Well, again, you know, that's an example. He was a food scientist. but still science, and he had an interest in science fiction. I don't know whether any of his characters ever ate donuts in his books. But yeah, you know, an example of somebody with a science background being interested in science fiction. All the way back then, he started writing his first novel in 1915. It was published in the 1920s. Yeah. And he wrote the Lensman series, famous series of seven novels.
Now, what is the Earth Similarity Index?
Okay, so this is, and I actually got a bit of a telling off from another scientist when he reviewed my book, because he said the Earth Similarity Index hasn't been adopted by everybody in the scientific community yet. But there's an astronomer at the University of Puerto Rico, his name is Abel Mendez, and he's developed the Earth Similarity Index as just a way of demonstrating how the potential for some of these planets that we're finding to be similar to Earth. So he measures things like how far these planets are from their star, how much heat they would receive, what size they are, things like that. And then he compares that with Earth and sees how similar they are. But again, it's so some of the planets are quite similar in those regards, that they receive the same amount of heat as Earth does, and they're about the same size as Earth is, and they orbit in the habitable zone like Earth does. But as he himself says, you know, Venus is on the inner edge of the habitable zone.
Yeah.
And, you know, if things had gone differently, Venus could have been habitable. So Venus would be close to Earth. So, it tells us, perhaps not as much as we would want it to.
And
it's an indicator of maybe where we should look when we're searching for Earth-like planets.
Yeah, and queen of outer space notwithstanding, what happened on Venus? Venus is one of the least inhabitable planets in our solar system. I mean, the climate on Venus is atrocious.
It is, but it wasn't always that way.
Yeah, that's the weird thing.
So some astronomers, and again, this is a little bit debated, but you know, we're going back into Venusian history billions of years, so there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. But some scientists think that Venus once had oceans.
Yeah.
And was maybe a lot more Earth-like than it is today. But because it's a little bit closer to the sun than Earth is, it received a little bit more heat from the sun. The oceans eventually evaporated. As we said, water vapor in the atmosphere is a greenhouse gas. It warmed the planet even more. The solar ultraviolet light would split the water molecules into their component oxygen and hydrogen atoms. The oxygen would react with silicate rock. And so all the oxygen and all the water would go away. And right now, Venus is just surrounded by this thick swath of carbon dioxide atmosphere. It's really thick. The surface pressure is, I forget the exact value, but we've sent probes, or I think the Soviets sent probes to land on Venus, and they lasted a couple of hours before the 462 degree Celsius temperature melted them and the pressure crushed them. So it's really inhospitable now, but we don't think it always was, and it's maybe a little bit of a warning to us on Earth not to mess about with the climate too much in terms of greenhouse gases and climate change.
Now, we have like 1 minute left, and I just want to ask you one question. What is be a fine girl or fine guy? Kiss me.
That is the stellar classification. So it was an astronomer, I think it was Henrietta Swan Leavitt, back in the 1920s. Early 20th century, and she came up, I think it was her, She came up with a way of classifying stars based on their temperature, which is reflected in their colour. And I don't know why these particular letters were chosen, but O-type stars are the hottest, most luminous. Then you've got B, A, F, G, K, and M, which are the M are the coolest. The Earth's sun, our sun, is a G-class star. But yeah, that's the O, B, A, F, G, K, M, O, be a fine girl, kiss me. that's where the acronym came from. It's just a way of remembering the stellar classes. But yeah, it's a funny limerick.
So on Star Trek, when they talk about M-class planet, is that what they're talking about? Or that's another, that was a classification.
Maybe they've either misunderstood the stellar classification system or they've just been inspired by it. But yeah, when they talk about an M-class planet, they're talking about a habitable planet.
Right, right.
But that's Star Trek jargon. That's not something that astronomers use.
We're completely out of time, and we haven't even started to talk about the really good stuff. Maybe we'll do another interview. My guest tonight is science journalist and editor Keith Cooper, and we've been talking about his new book, Amazing Worlds of Science Fiction and Science Fact. It's a really great read. Keith, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.